Welcome to the Ad Nauseam Podcast, where classical gourmands everywhere can finally get their fill. Join us for a delectable discussion of Greco-Roman civilization stretching from the Minoans and Mycenaeans through the Renaissance and right down to the present. And now, ladies and gentlemen, here are your hosts, Dr. David Noe and Dr. Jeff Winkle.
Welcome, listeners, to the second episode of the Ad Nauseam Podcast. The late Sir Hugh Lloyd-Jones, a British scholar, in his work, The Justice of Zeus, written in 1975, had this to say: one of the best reasons for studying the past is to protect oneself against that insularity in time which restricts the uneducated and those who write to please them. The ordinary man feels superior to the men of past ages, whose technology was inferior to what he is used to, and whose ethical and political beliefs were not those which he has been taught to consider as the only right ones. So today we're going to continue our conversation. We're going to start out talking about Homer's Iliad, the first work in Western Lit. I'm here with my co-host, Dr. Jeff Winkle. How are you this afternoon, Jeff?
I'm doing fabulous.
Good, good. So what kind of reception did we get for our inaugural episode that came out a couple weeks ago?
I thought we got some good positive feedback. We heard from some former students of ours.
Should we give a shout out to a young man? We'll call him Caleb, because that's his name.
That's right, yeah. And I believe he was known when he traveled with us. We called him Speedy.
I think that's right, because...
you guys had a foot race.
Oh, we didn't want to talk about that. So much,
but it was on the track at Ancient Olympia.
Yes, it was. And then we reprised that little competition at Kertamen when we went to Italy together.
That's right. I don't remember. Do you want to talk about the result of that?
Probably not. I think I didn't come off too well in that particular episode.
But Caleb sent us a nice note.
He did.
And that was very encouraging.
Yes, and we received some other good feedback from some friends and students and family who listened to the first episode, Classics as a Way of Life, and we hope that you're listening to this one as well. So Jeff, what do we have on tap today?
We're going to start a small kind of mini-series on Homer. And so as we talked about it, we kind of envisioned as at least a three-parter.
A three-parter.
Yeah. Homer's such a huge subject.
Right.
It might go well beyond that. But we're going to talk about the artistry of Homer today. So
okay.
Homer as a poet.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe down the line we'll talk about the history behind Homer, the archaeology,
right,
and this controversial... enigmatic persona, Heinrich Schliemann.
Schliemann, the German manufacturing expert,
yes,
and amateur archaeologist.
Yes, yes.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's for a later episode.
That's a later episode.
Like you said, today we're going to talk about Homer as an artist.
Right.
The first work in Western Lit, is it not?
It is.
And should we read a little bit of the beginning of the Iliad in some hexameter?
Go for it. You've got it right there in front of you,
I do, in fact. Yeah. Any professional classicists who are listening, they may want to close their ears at this point in case yours truly makes any errors in the scansion. But it sounds something like this. Menina e de tha pe le ia jo akele os. Ulamenein he muria kai ois. Alge efeke, paulas dif thimus psukas aedi pro iapsen, and so forth.
You know, that was my very first assignment in graduate school, was to memorize the first 100 lines in the Iliad and perform them.
Wow.
For a professor who was the spitting image of Poseidon.
That's incredible.
So it's a story for another day, though.
So yeah. The spitting image of Poseidon,
yes.
He had the shaggy beard.
Shaggy beard,
the
wild.
Heroic torso, so this individual went naked from the waist up most of the time?
He wasn't kind of full Aquaman, I would say that, but he had kind of piercing blue eyes, wild gray beard.
Right.
It looked like he had just emerged from the sea.
And he taught you scansion and how to memorize poetry.
He did. It was a trial by fire.
Right.
But I'm grateful for it.
Yeah, which is more of a Vulcan move, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely.
Than a Poseidon. He should be a...
a trial by Whirlpool.
There you go.
There you go. Yeah.
So the first word here, the first word in Western Lit is Menin, right? Which is a word that is often translated as wrath.
Rage,
anger. It's to me significant, as I like to tell my students, that the first word in Western Lit is anger.
Yeah.
So what does that indicate about Homer's perspective? Now, we're calling him Homer. Later on, we can talk about whether there was one Homer or 12 or no one named Homer.
Right.
But for the sake of convenience, we'll just refer to this individual as Homer. That he begins his poem with this word, anger. Sing, goddess, the anger of Achilles, the son of Peleus, a destructive anger, ulomenein, that sent many souls of the Greeks and the Trojans to Hades and left their bodies exposed on the fields and the plains of Troy. I got a little distracted there with the beauty of the poetry. Which books are we talking about today, Jeff?
We can't cover it all, but we're going to zero in on book one. Okay. We've kind of already started with that with the opening lines.
Right.
Book nine is a key book. When I've taught the Iliad and had to kind of pick and choose, I never leave out book nine. It's where Achilles is in his tent.
Right.
And some of his colleagues come to try to persuade him to come out of that tent.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about book 22, some of the climactic duels, and book 24, which
right.
wraps it up.
So we got these books that are hinge points for the plot.
Right.
So here, my understanding of this is shaped by a scholar named H.J. Rose. So he's not by any means a current scholar, but he wrote two nice little handbooks. One, a handbook of Greek literature, the other, a handbook of Latin literature. The scholarship in them is dated, no doubt, but he's a good stylist. It's very readable. It's comprehensive. It's available in a free PDF. Anyway, he says that the Iliad has three books, 1, 9, and 22, which advance the plot significantly. Also, the most common textbook assigned for beginning students in Homeric Greek is that of Alan Rogers Benner, and that includes those three books, 1, 9, and 22. So like you said, 1 is the beginning of the conflict, 9 is the embassy to Achilles, and 22, the death of Hector. When I was employed somewhere else, an individual, we'll call him a business associate, he said to me that he had read much of the Iliad over the weekend and that it was all trash.
All trash.
All trash. The central plot point, he remarked, was simply adultery. How could that be an epic? So what would we say in response to that kind of criticism? Because as the epic begins, we have this proemium about, you know, the muse and so forth, and then we go right, as Horace said, in medias res, right into the center of the action, and we have Achilles and Agamemnon involved in this dispute. What was the nature of that dispute?
It was over a woman.
A woman.
A woman who had been taken as a war prize,
right,
in a raiding party. And Agamemnon takes Achilles' war prize bride, war bride, away from him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what sparks that's the flashpoint of the main end.
So we have this young woman named Chryseis,
yes,
right, whose father is Chryses, and Chryses is a priest of Apollo,
right,
if I'm remembering correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And Chryses has his daughter stolen away as the war prize of Agamemnon, is that right?
And that's
then,
right.
And then Chryses goes down along the sea, as I'm remembering. We have with us today the Stanley Lombardo translation, mm-hmm, which I think is published by Hackett. And then, Jeff, what do you have?
I have the Robert Fagles.
The Fagles, right.
Yep.
It's a Penguin.
Penguin Classics, yep.
Right. So we'll be reading perhaps some excerpts of their translations, which are very nice. Different
right.
listeners will like different translations. So Chryses goes down along the much-pounding sea, and he utters this prayer to the god Apollo, and he says something along the lines of, give me back my daughter.
Right. He goes right to the top.
Right to the top.
Yeah. Yep.
Give me back my daughter. She was stolen unfairly. Apollo, smiter of mice, as the Greek has it.
Smintheos, I believe.
Smintheos, right.
The Greek, right.
Smiter of mice.
And I believe, isn't that the only time in all of Greek literature that he's called that?
I can check, but I think it's reprised in some of the tragedies of the 5th century
okay.
as a nod to Homer, right, in our archaic nod. Nevertheless, no one knows exactly what that epithet means, smiter of mice, but Chryses prays to Apollo and says, give me back my daughter.
Right.
Apollo hears. He descends from Olympus. He's got on his back a quiver. It's made of silver, and he has arrows made of silver, so they're obviously hypoallergenic, right? And they rattle on his shoulders.
That's one of my favorite details. The rattling of the quiver as he's coming down the mountain. It's horrifying, but beautiful.
It is.
Yeah.
Here comes Apollo, and he's going to wreak vengeance, which is really the only thing you can do with vengeance, on the entire camp, right? The entire camp of the Achaeans. And what ensues after that when he comes down?
Well, he starts firing these arrows of plague, and the Greeks start to die. I remember a professor of mine once suggested that the Smintheos, the mouse god, could have some kind of link between mice and plague.
Right.
And that's why Homer uses that term in that moment. His arrows bringing the disease on the Greeks. Yeah.
Because mice get into your flour box and other things, your bag of rice. They bring plague.
Yes.
You need to pray to Apollo to ward off rodents if you're going to have
right.
enough soup.
Exactly. Or bring them upon your enemies.
That's right.
Such is the case. Right.
So Apollo hears, answers, comes down, starts killing Greeks. The bodies pile up. The smoke rises up because the corpses are burned on different kinds of pyres. And this leads to conflict between the two chief heroes in the Greek camp. And they are, of course, Achilles, swift-footed, right?
Yes.
Podas Okus, I think, is his epithet, something along those lines. And Agamemnon.
Agamemnon.
Agamemnon's epithet, Lord of Men, Shepherd of the People, Poimen Alaon, Wanaxandron. Why these two linked in combat?
Well, you have Agamemnon, who's politically speaking at the top of the food chain.
Right.
He is he's the Lord of Mycenae. The wealthiest, most powerful city. So when it kind of came down to who's going to lead this expedition. Time to go get back Helen, right? It fell to him. And so as I often try to make clear to my, I see a misconception that some of my students will often have, is they think of Greece as a nation.
Right.
And Agamemnon is the king of the Greeks.
Right.
Which is not really the case.
No.
You have these separate mini kingdoms and they each have their own kings.
Yes. He's a warlord.
He's a warlord, right.
And temporarily the chief of all the warlords.
Yes.
And if I'm remembering correctly, this is the pre-Homeric elements. Now, we don't have any literature before Homer, but we have stories about things that happened before the time of the Trojan War.
Right.
We have the voyage of Jason. We have all of the epic cycle, as it's called, Tisichorus, I think, is one of the names.
Right.
And some others. And they say that when all the heroes were competing over Helen's hand in marriage, they took an oath that if anyone, whoever won the hand of Helen in this contest, the others would defend his right to keep Helen's hand in marriage.
That's right.
So Menelaus won, the king of Sparta, the brother of Agamemnon.
Yes.
And after that happened, when she was stolen away, they all had to launch their expedition to get her back.
Right.
Because of this pact, this agreement.
So there's stories about Agamemnon and Menelaus going around really drafting kings into the cause.
Yeah, even those quite reluctant.
Specifically
Odysseus, which is a story for another day.
Right.
And Achilles was reluctant as well.
Right.
Dressed as a woman to avoid detection so he wouldn't have to go to Troy.
It was his mom, really, who had more of the misgivings, I think, and so she kind of shuttered him away. But,
yes.
Yeah, but it falls into that same
That part I don't remember, although I'm sure you're right about it. Yeah. So then Agamemnon is the politically most important individual at Troy.
Right.
He has all the authority. He has all the power.
Yes.
He's the one who marshals with his scepter given by Zeus. He marshals all the forces. But he's not, by nature, the most significant individual.
No. In terms of who's the best on the field, it's Achilles by far. Agamemnon does have his moment of aristeia in the Iliad, kind of his moment on the stage of excellence. But it's this clash between the guy who has the most political clout and the guy who is the best warrior.
Right. So this is significant to my mind because it plays out throughout the remainder of classical literature. The conflict between those who are naturally superior and those who are superior by convention, by the votes of their peers, their fellow citizens.
Yes.
So getting back to the main plot point then, when Chryseis is taken away from Agamemnon, they get together, they all agree, in order to satisfy Apollo and to stop this plague, we have to give this young woman, Chryseis, back to her father, who is the priest of Apollo.
Right.
Agamemnon says, okay, you can do that, but if you're taking away my woman,
I've got to take some of her myself. It's the loss of face, the loss of honor.
Yes.
Right? Takes him. Agamemnon, like all these heroes, are very aware of their place on the totem pole.
Yes.
And so suddenly, if he's lost his prize, he's no longer top dog.
Yeah. So this reminds me of a quote from a very important Greek scholar, German scholar of Homer, named Werner Jaeger, in his work Paideia. He says, Homer and the aristocracy of his time believed that the denial of honor due was the greatest of human tragedies. The heroes treat one another with constant respect, since their whole social system depends on such respect. They have an insatiable thirst for honor, a thirst which is itself a moral quality of individual heroes. So this is the answer that I would make to my friend who said, it's all about adultery. Well, yes, they're fighting over women, but for better or worse, the contest over women represents a contest of individual honor.
Right. And it's a plot point that opens the door to all of these other things.
Yes.
Right? The Iliad is, yes, it's about honor, but it's about the cost, the meaning of human life. What gives life purpose? What does it mean to be a hero?
Yeah. How do we define excellence?
Exactly. Is there meaning in these hundreds, thousands of deaths on the battlefield?
Right.
It's the biggest of human questions in the very first work of Western literature.
Yeah. Menina Aida, anger. So Agamemnon says, yeah, I'll give up Chryseis, but I got to take someone else. And so he goes to Achilles. Bad choice.
Bad choice.
Because Achilles is his natural superior. He is faster on the battlefield. He even at one point will confront and attack Mars himself, Ares,
right,
if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, and Ares catches a spear in the gut.
That's right.
Yes.
Because Achilles is just so naturally powerful.
Right.
So Agamemnon says, I'm going to take Briseis.
You can see what he's doing, though, right? I mean, it's a bad move. But if Agamemnon is insecure about his place, he sees a way of taking Achilles down a peg without stepping head-to-head, hand-to-hand.
He doesn't have to confront Achilles on the battlefield.
Exactly.
He can use political manipulation to show that he is Achilles better.
Exactly right.
By stealing his prize.
Yes.
I think a lot of contemporary audiences, and I think this is what was motivating my friend's comment, they get distracted by the fact that they're fighting over a woman.
Right.
They think that's a low motive. And it may be. I don't know. I'm not suggesting. The Ad Nauseam podcast, its official position is not to suggest that women ought to be traded as prize of war.
No.
Are you with me on this?
I am with you, but it's known as the bride-stealing motif.
Yes.
You see it in literature around the world throughout
right.
the ages, right? So this is a very common kind of
right.
plot point. And to zero in on that, I think, is to really miss the bigger picture.
Yes,
yeah.
Indeed. And as another friend once said, I can name this individual, Dr. Kevin Culberson, if he's listening. Yeah, he used to say that he taught English and history and so forth, that contemporary audiences are surprised that this whole conflict is about beauty at some level, whereas we tend to fight over things that are much more material. We would fight over territory, maybe petroleum, not
yeah.
to get too political, but these kinds of things make sense to us. But that an ancient audience fought over beauty seems odd. And his point was, maybe that's better. Maybe at some level, it's better to fight over beauty than over the kinds of things that have characterized so many human conflicts.
That's great. I've never heard it put that way before, but
right.
that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it takes us back to the Lloyd-Jones quote that you started with, is this reminder, you know, not to kind of sneer at the past because of their lack of technology or just because they're so different from
right.
there. And then also kind of this reminder not to impose our own viewpoints onto the past
right.
and assume that they would have or should have seen things like we do.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So then Briseis is marched away from the tent of Achilles and to the tent of Agamemnon. And Agamemnon, I don't have the Greek right here before me, but readers can find it in any good translation. Right near the beginning, when she's taken away, Agamemnon makes this really salacious boast, right? That I will keep Briseis and I'll do with her as I please. She will be in my bed, actually, you know, for as long as I want. And Achilles, you can't do anything about it because I am the king of this expedition. I'm in charge.
Yes.
And Achilles responds then,
fine, I'll take my ball and go home.
That's right.
Yeah.
I'm going to indulge in a, what, 21? No, let's see. Is it book 18? He comes back to the battlefield.
That's right.
When
yeah.
he gets the shield. I'm going to indulge in a 17-book pout.
That's right. Exactly.
I'm heading off to my tent.
Right. And Agamemnon, as if the taking of Briseis is not hubristic enough.
Right.
You're right. He goes even further with that speech,
mm-hmm.
basically spitting in Achilles'
sure.
face. Right.
So in the interest of base flattery, the Ad Nauseam audience is probably one of the most educated that one could find in a podcast audience.
Without a doubt.
But maybe for the purposes of some who don't know, what is this word hubris?
Hubris. It's often unpacked in English as meaning excessive pride.
Okay.
I personally don't like that. I think
you don't like the definition excessive pride.
I don't think it gets really a kind of the full range of that.
Okay.
I think I always see it as a Greek would say it's going too far,
mm-hmm.
not knowing thyself, not
right.
knowing your place, and stepping over a line. Everybody's line is maybe a bit different.
Right.
And so Agamemnon, with his action, with his words, is stepping over a line that
mm-hmm.
he can't uncross.
So from the perspective of someone who's a Christian, myself, what would be an appropriate amount of pride? Because we're dealing here with some different kinds of ideas.
Right.
I mean, I have an answer, but I just want to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, like I said, it's a pride that, I see so much in when I read and I teach Greek myth is a problem of humanity is not knowing their place
okay.
In relationship to the gods.
Right.
Right.
And to nature.
Into nature. Right.
Right.
And so often the crossing of line that involves a hubristic act is not a clear one. It's kind
right.
of this fuzzy gray areas. That's what makes it maddening, but also really, really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And so Agamemnon, who's kind of at the top of the food chain, he can push the envelope perhaps in a way other characters cannot.
Right.
But I think we're supposed to see in the Iliad that he's taken it way too far.
Yeah.
And he's kind of, you know, sowing the seeds of his own destruction or the destruction of his soldiers.
And his society generally.
Yes.
Right. So I often tell my students, you know, in the classroom, when it's a myth class or a lit course, I say, we are a really poor excuse here for Greek society because we've been together for how many weeks? and we haven't yet established who runs the fastest.
Yeah.
We don't know who's the most beautiful, right? Whether male or female, who can lift the most, who can jump the farthest, who has the best ability to spew poetry and rhyme.
Right.
Right. A poor excuse for a Greek society. And they chuckle a little bit because I'm grading them, right? And I point out that, you know, Greek society is agonistic.
Right. The agon.
That's right.
The contest.
We don't know the gifts the gods have given us until we compete.
Right.
So that's really what's at stake here, I would say, in the Iliad is who's the best, right? And so hubris is going beyond the allotment of what the gods have given you.
Yes.
If you are really the fastest runner, you're Usain Bolt, right?
Yep.
Then you must tell the world, I am the fastest, I'm the greatest of all time,
right.
Muhammad Ali. And the reason is the gods gave you those gifts. So if you don't credit them with your natural ability, it's irreligious.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I often find students are often turned off by the boasting.
Definitely.
That characters do. And I think like in the Iliad, there's bad boasting,
yeah.
And there's appropriate boasting. But I find that your typical modern-day student is turned off by the lack of humility.
Right.
Humility is not a virtue.
It's not a classical virtue at all.
At all, right. And so,
but they also don't understand, I would say, that the boasting is not an entirely personal motive. It's about establishing societal position.
Yes.
Right? So if a person has no ability on the guitar, right, and they pretend to be Andreas Segovia, Paul Gilbert, right. Eddie Van Halen, they're a fraud.
Exactly. Which is, I have a theory about anybody that you see playing guitar on the front porch,
yeah,
falls into that category.
Okay. Didn't Bryan Adams play the guitar on the front porch?
I rest my case.
Okay. In any event, if you're really great at something, though, whom are you going to credit? Yeah, moderns, our contemporaries, credit themselves.
Yes.
The ancients would say, I'm the best because Zeus made me so, right?
Right.
And there's a whole genre of literature, Pindar's odes and epodes, his victory odes. You're the greatest in the Olympic Games or in the Nemean Games, and Zeus made you so.
Yes.
So here's the boast.
Right. And that also reminds me, you know, how many stories are there about a mortal who's really good at something, and they make the mistake of boasting that they're better?
Exactly.
Right. So, I mean, the classic example is Arachne.
Yep.
The great weaver compares herself to Athena.
Mm-hmm.
And it ends badly for her.
So hubris is going above what the gods have given you.
Yes.
But unlike contemporaries, unlike moderns ourselves, if the gods have given you a lot, you have an active moral obligation to tell your fellow mortals, the gods made me the best. You know, I can sing the best. I'm the best looking. My face could launch 1,000 ships.
Yes.
Your face only 850, perhaps, and things of that nature.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. There's no virtue in humility of self-deprecation.
No.
No.
It's completely foreign to the classical world.
Yeah, it's true.
Comes in much later, of course, and when we have the time to talk about individuals like St. Augustine,
yes.
We'll talk about the recharacterization of these classical virtues. Let's pause now a moment to get a word from our sponsor.
This episode is brought to you by the Moss Method for Greek. How are you spending your leisure time? If you consume only pop culture, your mind will become weak and emaciated. With so many ways to fill your free time, why not try learning ancient Greek? It's much easier than you think and will deeply enrich your life. Go to mossmethod.com. Simple, accessible, expert Greek instruction. That's mossmethod.com. Start your journey with Greek today.
All right, so we set the stage for the Iliad and the central conflict, which starts everything in book one. But now let's take a look at some other scenes. And I'd like to shift here to book six, where there's this really interesting, and I think central to understanding some of the deeper themes of the Iliad, this duel.
Right.
Between Glaucus and Diomedes. So Glaucus is a Trojan warrior, one of the best on the field, and he
right.
meets up with Diomedes,
right.
Who we also hear a lot more about in the Iliad. Tell us a little bit about Diomedes.
Yeah, so we're gonna skip, Jeff, are you saying? We're gonna skip Thersites and the dream of Agamemnon.
It kills me to do so.
And the catalog of ships.
There's so much to do here, but
yes.
we only have so much time.
That's true.
Yeah.
All right, we don't want to tax our audience. So, book six, like you said, we've got Diomedes, the son of Tydeus, Diomedes, whose epithet is good at the war cry, Boein Agathon.
Right. It makes you think of, like, I always see, like, Stallone or Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, in that role?
Not in that role, but he's kind of the incoherent shouting.
Okay.
Yeah.
A particular movie in mind?
They shout in every film, don't
Pretty
they?
Pretty much. Yeah. So Diomedes, good at the war cry. What does that mean?
Think about the chaos of the battlefield,
right.
the crush of the line of warriors. To try to have any kind of organization and try to get your warriors to go where you want to go, you have to have someone who's good at shouting.
Right.
And Diomedes is your guy.
His voice carries over the din of battle,
there
right?
There you go.
The smoke and the choke and allows people to hear where they're supposed to move when.
That's right.
Right. So as the listeners might know, Homeric warfare is not the hoplite warfare that we find in historical times.
Right.
As one of my teachers described it, it's more like, this dates us, but it's more like an individual gets in a taxi, he races to the front line, he jumps out, throws a few punches, gets in the taxi, and goes back behind the battle line and has a wine cooler or something like that.
That's right, exactly.
We'd have to update it with Uber now, I suppose, right, or Lyft.
Yes.
But chariot warfare is not the warfare of the ranks of battle, the phalanx.
Right.
So Glaucus and Diomedes, they meet up on the battlefield. Diomedes good at the war cry, and he encounters Glaucus. Now, I'm going to read a little portion here from the Stanley Lombardo translation of the Iliad. Very nice translation. And this is when Glaucus first encounters Diomedes. He says, "And Glaucus, Hippolochus's son, he says, great son of Tydeus, why ask about my lineage? Human generations are like leaves in their seasons. The wind blows them to the ground, but the tree sprouts new ones when spring comes again. Men, too, their generations come and go. But if you really do want to hear my story, you're welcome to listen. Many men know it."
Yes. I hear Kansas's Dust in the Wind.
That's right.
Playing behind that, right?
That's right. Absolutely. So it turns out that Glaucus and Diomedes are old friends, or more specifically, their families, their fathers and grandfathers, were at one time acquaintances and this special Greek idea of guest friendship.
Yes.
They had xenia.
Xenia, right. In which, you know, ties between families, the host-guest relationship. What I find so fascinating about this is we quickly learn this, that supersedes any type of identity as being Trojan or Greek. Right. Another misconception I think that a lot of my students bring to this is they think of this story as kind of Greeks versus Trojans. And they often bring with the assumption that the Greeks are the good guys and
right.
the Trojans are the bad guys,
mm-hmm.
when I think the argument's quite the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
But a scene like this tells us that there's kind of a hierarchy of importance. And so for Glaucus and Diomedes, it's the fact that they have this family history of guest friendship
mm-hmm.
is way more important than their loyalty, you might call it, to the Trojan or the Greek side.
That's right.
Yeah.
So to contextualize a little bit, a few generations from now, when, you know, my granddaughter and your grandson meet up in some business setting and they're trying to hash out a deal, right, buying or selling a house or advertising or something, and the argument's getting kind of heated and the Winkles and the Noes are about to, you know, draw on one another, and all of a sudden your granddaughter says, "Wait a minute, wasn't your grandfather involved in that short-lived but glorious podcast ad nauseum with my grandfather?"
Yes.
And all of a sudden, the conflict ends.
Exactly right. Everything is smoothed over.
They
and
sit
that supersedes
down.
Everything.
Right. They
right.
sit down, they open a picnic basket, which is basically what Glaucus and Diomedes do on the battlefield. They open up this picnic basket, and they start to compare notes of genealogy.
Yes, exactly right. And so I'll read a little bit from Diomedes' response. So after Glaucus kind of goes through this history, and there's kind of an absurdism about it. Imagine
mm-hmm.
kind of the crush of war happening around these guys as they're chatting about
right.
about their family history.
I always picture them, you know, with a bucket of chicken and
yeah.
maybe some deviled eggs or so forth, and they're sitting on a nice red and white checkered blanket.
And the wine cooler you mentioned.
Exactly.
There's the wine cooler. Right.
Yeah, I don't care for wine coolers, just for the record.
But so Diomedes hears this story, and I'll read a little bit from Robert Fagel's translation. It says, "When he heard that, Diomedes' spirits lifted. Raising his spear, the lord of the war cry drove it home, planting it deep down in the earth that feeds us all. And with winning words, he called out to Glaucus, the young captain, 'Splendid. You are my friend, my guest from the days of our grandfathers long ago. Noble Oeneus hosted your brave Bellerophon once. He held him there in his halls 20 whole days, and they gave each other handsome gifts of friendship.'"
Hmm.
And so they decide in that moment that they can't fight each other because of this connection. Mm. But what I think is kind of doubly fascinating is it brings us back to what you were saying about very much the Iliad is about who is best. Even though they're not fighting, it's still a contest. And so when they exchange gifts, as guest friends do, Homer still tells us who won.
Yes.
Yeah.
And who did win?
I'll just read from Fagel's translation.
And before you do, if I can just interrupt.
Yeah.
How can there be a winning in the exchange of gifts?
Well, who gives the better gift or who gets the better gift?
So you're saying that even on a Christmas morning, when the Greeks are gathered around the tree and they open presents.
Oh, it's all agon all the time.
It's not really about showing your brother, your sister, your mother, your father, your cousin, that you, your girlfriend, that you love them.
Yes.
It's about saying who got the best gift.
Exactly. Or it reminds me of like Michael Scott in a Yankee Swap episode of The Office. Who gives the best gift?
That's right.
Exactly right.
It was an iPod, if I'm not mistaken.
It was an iPod. Exactly right. So Fagel's translates in that moment when they decide, we can't fight. Both fighters sprang from their chariots, clasped each other's hands, and traded pacts of friendship. But the son of Cronos, Zeus, stole Glaucus's wits away. He traded his gold armor for bronze with Diomedes, the worth of 100 oxen. Just for 9.
Hmm. So he traded away his gold-plated armor or solid gold armor for the bronze armor of Diomedes.
Right. But practically speaking, bronze is a much better metal for armor.
I think so.
Gold's a very soft metal.
Yes, but if you're wearing gold, you're going to stay cooler because it conducts heat better.
Is that right?
For those engineers who are listening.
Yes, but you also kind of make you put a bullseye on yourself because you're all shiny.
That's true.
Right, exactly.
That's true. Yeah. Now, what's odd about this is that of course, Zeus had to steal away Glaucus's sense in order for this trade exchange to happen. But Glaucus had just told Diomedes not too many lines before. In fact, it's line 208 of the Greek text. I'm going to read a little bit of Greek here because it's so beautiful. And he reads this line. He says, I in aristo wein kahuper rakon emmenai allon, which translates something like this. My father sent me here always to excel and to surpass all others. We have here this verb, this infinitive, aristewain, which means to be excellent. It's where our English word aristocracy comes
from. Right.
So Glaucus was dispatched there by his father Hippolochus. Go to Troy, Glaucus, fight those nasty Greeks, and demonstrate how great you are. Bring glory and honor to all of our lineage and our heritage, our extended family. We can put this in the Christmas card. You know, here's a shot of Glaucus at Troy, and look at how many Greeks he killed. But it all goes astray.
Right. It's Homer tells us, Zeus takes his wits away in the moment, and he makes a bad deal.
He makes a bad deal.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit more about Diomedes while we're in Book 6, because the entire book is called the Diomedeia, right? The exploits of Diomedes.
Right. So Diomedes is one of a handful of warriors from both the Greek and the Trojan side who get their moment on the stage, their moment of the sun, their aristeia.
Mm-hmm.
And Diomedes is probably best remembered for actually wounding the goddess Aphrodite on the battlefield.
Now, wait a minute.
Yeah.
The gods and goddesses can be wounded?
They can be.
I'm feigning surprise here.
Yes, they can be. They're extremely human. They bleed ichor, not blood.
Okay.
But they suffer pain.
What does ichor look like?
It's kind of oozy.
It's oozy, and it's clear, isn't it?
Is it clear? It is clear.
Yeah, because they don't drink wine. So
No. Why
is our blood the color that it is?
That's an excellent question.
Consumption of wine.
Is that how the Greeks explain
well,
that?
Well, I wouldn't say that their scientific understanding was quite that limited, but there does seem to be a suggestion that the blood of the gods is the color it is because of what they consume.
Because of ambrosia.
Yes.
Okay.
Ambrosia and nectar. So the food of the gods is ambrosia, which sounds like a potpourri or a candle series. But ambrosia, the word actually means immortality, not able to die.
Right.
Right? It's like the Latin im mors, not death. That alpha on ambrosia is an alpha privative. So ambrotos, you can't die.
Right.
I learned that from Jack Holtzmark, great grad school professor of mine. So they eat ambrosia. If you're going to retain your immortality, you have to eat immortality, and they drink nectar.
Gotcha.
Which is not easy to come by.
No, not
much
at all.
More expensive than Mountain Dew.
That's very, very true. Yeah. So, so Glaucus, he loses this battle. He's taken down a peg, and Homer tells us that there. Well, we've learned throughout now. There's many ways to there's many ways to fight.
Right.
There's many ways to compete. And so, you know, Agamemnon takes away Achilles' war prize. Mm-hmm. There's, of course, the visceral bloodletting on the battlefield itself.
Right.
And here, just this seemingly innocuous exchange of gifts is
still a contest.
Still a contest.
And Glaucus loses. Diomedes goes on to wound Aphrodite, goddess, on her wrist.
On her wrist.
If I'm not mistaken.
Yes. And while she's attempting to get her son, Aeneas, one of the principal warriors, Trojan warriors, off the battlefield. And she's wounded, and then she goes running back up to Olympus to
cry to daddy.
Cry to daddy.
There's a famous Ingres painting. I'm not a scholar of French, so I'm probably mispronouncing that. But the painting, you all have probably seen it. I'm pantomiming it here, of Aphrodite sitting in her chariot with her wrist flopped over. I think it's her left wrist. And you can see a little bit of the ichor flowing out of it because Diomedes has done what no one else could do, which is wound an immortal on her wrist.
Well, I think we're getting up against our time.
Okay. They kick us out of the vomitorium here, our studio in Grand Rapids.
Right. And we kind of figured it might go this way. I mean, it's such a, we even skipping several books.
It's rich.
It's rich.
And skipped my favorite scene, actually.
Which is?
Well, it's the Tecoscopia. Is where Helen is on top of the walls of Troy, and she's looking out over the battlefield.
Oh, right, yes.
And Priam, her unwilling father-in-law, because, you know, Paris is the son of Priam. Paris stole Helen. Paris says, Helen, tell me the names of all these heroes out on the field. Who are these various individuals?
Right.
And there's the duel, right, between Menelaus
and
Paris.
Great scene.
Yeah, Paris or Alexander, he's got two names, sneaks off to hide from Menelaus, because Menelaus is obviously the better man.
Yes.
And getting back to Aphrodite, she rescues poor Paris at the last minute, drops him right down in Helen's boudoir.
Right, where she tears into him.
Right.
Right. It's so extraordinary about that scene, the Tecoscopia, is how kind Priam is to Helen.
Yes, he is.
I mean, he could so easily say, this is all your fault. But he literally says, I don't blame you.
That's right.
Right. And
even though Homer and others throughout the story call her Kunops.
That's true.
Dog-faced,
right.
Right.
Yes, dogs get a bad rap in the
Iliad.
In the Odyssey, dogs are much more
that's true.
Much more beloved.
Dogs are either the one to whom you are unfavorably compared.
Right.
Dogs are the ones who consume you after you die in the battlefield.
That's right.
That's exactly pretty much the only use for dogs in the Iliad.
Right.
So that dog face... Helen, she's treated nicely by Priam, and that's one of my favorite scenes there in the Iliad.
It's a great scene.
But we had to skip it, go on to book 6. So looking forward to the next episodes, Jeff, what do we have in store?
Well, I think we're going to pick it up in the next episode with, I think like we said earlier, with book 9. We'll talk about the famous embassy where Achilles is in his tent. He's pouting, and Agamemnon is desperate to get him back.
Because
the without their star quarterback.
Right.
They're getting pushed back into their own territory.
Yeah.
And so they need him back. And so Agamemnon's getting desperate. He's on the verge of even hanging it up.
Yeah. And he says, we got to go get Achilles.
Yes.
So does he go himself?
Of course not.
Okay.
Because not. He's a coward.
He sends some lackeys.
He does.
Right.
Yep. And so, yeah, I think that's we'll pick it up. We'll get into a great scene.
Looking forward to that. And I especially like the way you ended the previous episode.
Yes.
Some little tagline. It brought up gustatory elements.
Right.
Theme of this podcast.
Right. I say, well, I think, as always, I think last time I used a well-known French phrase.
Right.
But this time I just thank everybody for listening.
Right.
And encourage them to always eat fresh.
Eat fresh. All right.
See ya.
Thanks.